pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener, to the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, episode 36. And with me is the Velvet Glove. Scott, how are you?
I've never better, Trevor. How's yourself?
I'm well. I had to work hard earlier this week, which is a little bit unusual for me, but I'm recovering and I'm going to run through the finish line of the week with a wet sail.
So I'm pleased to hear that. Yes, pleased to hear that indeed.
So once again, the anti-secular forces in the world, Scott, have conspired to produce plenty of material for our podcast.
They have, yes, and some surprising events too have come up amongst that lot. But anyway,
there is.
We'll get through it. Yeah,
a lot of them, dear listener, are looking uncomfortably like the sorts of things you'd see in the Bible Belt in America, and they're here in our home turf. So anyway, before we get into the really ugly stuff that's just going to depress you, dear listener, we will kick off with, you might remember that I made contact with our education minister in Queensland, and she said you've got to get, if you want changes in Queensland, then you'll need the approval of relevant stakeholders, which included the Teachers Union, the Principals Association, and the PNC. And I made contact with the union first off because I know that Kevin Bates, the president, is very much on side, and I've met him before, and it took a while to get a response from him, but we eventually got one. And the good news is that he confirmed that by an email that the Queensland Teachers Union State Council met on the 12th of March and determined to call on the minister to undertake a full review of legislation requiring time allocation to religious instruction. And they're doing it on the basis of a review of the curriculum that's being undertaken and aiming at decluttering the curriculum and basically saying that they want the religious instruction time to be removed and allocated to other resources. So that's the position of the Teachers Union. So that's one down, two to go, Scott.
Well, that is good news. Yes, that's very good news. So it's now got the Principals Association and the PNC, did you say?
Yeah. So talking about those two, he did mention Kevin Bates because I said to him, you know, in Victoria they have changed and they've simply wiped out religion from school hours and, you know, looking to do that in Queensland. And he made the point that in Victoria they only needed to do a policy change. It wasn't part of legislation, whereas in Queensland it's actually part of legislation. So it's going to be more difficult to get that through. And let's face it, Scott, in Queensland at the moment, with defecting politicians left, right and centre, the Palaszczuk government could struggle to pass anything. And given that the balance of power is with these sort of conservative northern elements and the Katter people, I think even if Kate Jones wanted to, she probably couldn't get it past them. Do you reckon?
I think that's probably exactly right, is that, you know, that they can't, they no longer got a majority, so they are in a bind, I think, that they're going to be stuck with the legislation the way it is.
Yeah, I suspect that the Katter Party and the other sort of quasi-independents are just don't strike me as the type who are looking to get rid of religious instruction anytime soon. But
No.
But anyway, the other two stakeholders that we've got to get are the Principals Association and the PNC. And yes. I'd kind of held off contacting the Principals Association because I was wanting to get advice from Kevin Bates of the Teachers Union as to best way to approach it, etc. But anyway, unfortunately, Scott, I stumbled across an article from the Courier Mail from 2004, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the State School's principal president, Michael Fay, is quoted in that. And he's the current one as well. Like, he's been there a while.
Yeah.
And in that article, unfortunately, he says that he believed religious instruction provided a good ethics foundation for young children and was available to students of all faiths with appropriate permissions.
Oh, please.
Yeah. This was in response to allegations that there was lots of people who were not supposed to be in these classes because their enrolment form says they shouldn't be. And he also says, in the article it says, he accused, Hugh Wilson of the Australian Secular Lobby accused principals of ignoring the policy, the fact that you have to opt in. But Mr. Fay denied the claim and said he did not think the 396,000 figure would be a true representation of parental permissions. So the fact that he believes religious instruction provides a good ethics foundation makes me think that he's not going to be amenable to our thoughts.
No, it doesn't sound like it. No, it sounds like he's going to be a obstructionist in the fight to repeal that.
Anyway, we'll find out. So stay tuned, folks, and we'll see what happens. And just while on that topic, on Facebook, I'm following Queensland Parents for Secular State Schools. Do you follow them, Scott?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
They often come out with good stuff. And they also have got hold of some books from the Christian Connect program. So this is the religious indoctrination books that Scripture Union are using in Queensland. And they found a really interesting lesson that they were mentioned in their Facebook post. So I thought that was worth a mention. They said, in Lesson 7 of the Christian Connect program for lower primary ages, 7 to 9 year old children, is a discussion that the religious instruction volunteer is to have with children about vampires and the Twilight series. So it goes on. This is sort of quoting from, this is what the instructor is to say to the children in a class situation. These books are about vampires. Who can tell me what they think a vampire is? Of course, kids give their responses. Teacher says, are vampires real? The teacher accepts responses and no, they're not real. Teacher then says, in these made-up stories about vampires, how do you think someone becomes a scary vampire? And again, the teacher accepts responses, you know, along the lines that a vampire bites them, drinks their blood, person dies, person becomes to life again, but they're a vampire. And then it goes on to say, this is what the instructor is supposed to say to the children. There aren't any vampires in the Bible because the Bible is not a made-up book. It is a book of containing facts. But there are some true stories in the Bible about people dying and then coming back to life again. And we're going to look at one now.
If only
people knew what crap their kids are listening to.
It's really awful, isn't it? What age group did you say that was for?
7 to 9 year old
children. Yeah, okay. 7 to 9 year old children are going to be sitting there listening to this, and they're not going to be able to tell the difference between when they're being lied to and when they're not being lied to.
Of course they're not.
It's ridiculous that anyone would think that this could have anything to do with anything decent or nice or, you know, whatever. It's ridiculous.
Scott, it's more than ridiculous. It's plain evil. Like, it is evil to be promoting these sorts of ideas into kids' heads. Oh, God, that just, in this day and age, there aren't any vampires in the Bible because the Bible is not a made-up book. It is a book containing facts. But there are some true stories in the Bible about people dying and then coming back to life again. And we're going to look at one now. And, of course, a story about Jesus, either himself coming back to life or curing people who are already dead. Oh, God's sake.
It's evil. Yeah, it is evil.
Dear listener, if that doesn't have your blood boiling about these religious instruction classes, I don't know what will.
Yeah.
Scott, do you like Mel Gibson?
Well, yeah, I did until I read the Daily Mail article. Oh, look, I do like him as an actor and all that sort of stuff, but honestly, I had no idea that he was that far into this. You know, I mean, I knew he was Christian and that sort of stuff, but I had no idea that he was so far into it that he was putting up, is it $1 million of his own money, or is he...
No, or is he provided some autographed memorabilia to help raise funds. But okay. Dear listener, imagine this, dear listener. You are in the outback. You're 230 kilometres west of Alice Springs, and there's a big hill called Memory Mountain, which at the moment is just a hill. But some people, including a photographer called Ken Duncan and his friend Mel Gibson, decided that just having a hill wasn't good enough. And what would really set it off would be a 20-metre tall crucifix with LED lights popped on top.
It's really awful. I'm assuming they're going to have solar panels to actually run the electricity on this thing, are they?
I didn't read that far. I don't know, Scott.
Well, imagine they're going to have to put solar panels out there, but, you know, this is... It's madness to... Where was it? They were raising money and they were selling stuff that he had signed and all that sort of thing that was... Oh, no, I've lost it.
He had
provided stuff that he had signed and that sort of stuff that was helping to raise money for it. And they had this goal of getting $1 million together so they could build this bloody 20-metre-high tall crucifix. Mm. It's ridiculous.
Mm.
But here it is. Who would commit more than $100,000 are referred to as platinum commanders and receive a helmet or sword, only one of each is available, from the Passion of the Christ movie, beautifully presented in Perspex display case signed by Mel Gibson himself. Golden Generals donate more than $50,000 and awarded a one-framed archival print from the Passion of the Christ movie signed by Mel Gibson.
Yes. So this Ken Duncan has been moved by the good Lord to put this cross on this hill and to raise $920,000, of which, Scott, they already have $351,000. So they're more than a third of the way there.
Oh, my God.
And the way they've done it in terms of donations is that they've used very Roman sort of names to make people feel good if they're going to donate. So, as you said, did you mention what was the name you called, like a centurion or something like that? What was it?
Platinum commanders.
Yeah, 100,000. You're a platinum commander. And
the Golden General if you donate more than $50,000.
Yes, but if you can't come up with that money, then for lesser sums, you can be a Silver Tribune, a Diamond Centurion, a Sapphire Centurion. Look, for a mere $2,500, you could be a Ruby Centurion, Scott.
Wow.
Warrior Soldier, you only need to contribute $1,000. A Faithful Soldier, $50. We'll get you that. And... finally, an armor bearer, $5.
So, if any of our listeners are feeling, you know, generous enough to donate to this cause, follow the link on the Daily Mail.
If you are, stop listening because we don't want you.
Yeah.
Unsubscribe now if you are at all inclined. Oh, for goodness sake.
It's ridiculous.
But, Scott, I think, beginning to believe in miracles. Because it apparently, according to the website they've got, which is called Help Raise the Cross, they've got permission from the various Aboriginal elder groups that they need in order to pull this off. Like, it states on the website that they've got... I think they needed four different tribes to agree to this. How they managed to do that, God only knows, literally, Scott.
Well, they managed to do it somehow, but bloody hell, it's ridiculous that they managed to convince them that they had to sign up to it, you know? I mean, it makes you wonder whether or not, you know,
that 920,000, how much that's been used to grease the wheels for it?
Well, good question, Scott, because I reckon, reading between the lines on between the article and the website, it seemed to me that there's like a board which is in charge of this project, and that some of the Aboriginal groups have made it onto the board, or some members have. And it would be interesting to know what the full story is there, and maybe we'll investigate that a bit further. Or maybe one of our dear listeners will, and come back to us with some information.
And they can come on. They can come on the show via Skype.
They could. We haven't mentioned that recently, but yes, anyone out there who'd got an idea or something to discuss, help us out with, you're welcome to make contact via the Facebook page, and we'll do a Skype call, and you'll have your 15 minutes of fame with us on the podcast. So, Scott, so that's just crazy. I mean, these are the sorts of things that happen in America, building giant arcs and, you know, Ten Commandments.
Yeah, it's exactly. That's exactly where you would expect to find something like this.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Scary. And so, Scott, literally half an hour ago, I was just catching up on some Facebook, relaxing prior to our podcast.
Yes.
And I stumbled across an article, and apparently you stumbled across it simultaneously. Do you want to tell people about our new favourite?
Our new favourite. Liberal Party's youngest ever senator is preparing to pursue radical reforms, including throwing out the national curriculum, relocating the Australian embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and reimposing a debt ceiling.
Mm.
Senator James Patterson has told the Fairfax media he has no intention of staying in Parliament for the sake of it. I'm not here for personal power or end advancement. You can go through the article yourself, but the part that really frightened me was when we got down to the end of it all, it said links to Corey Bernardi. And, you know, that's something that never ends well. But Senator Patterson...
doesn't begin well. And
it doesn't begin well and therefore can never end well. Senator Patterson was the surprise winner of a recent Liberal Party Senate pre-selection battle to replace the retiring Michael Ronaldson. His victory makes him the party's youngest ever senator, but he hoped to be judged on his input, not age. The great benefit of being a young person coming into Parliament is that I have long-term ideas to prosecute them as long as I have the blessing of the Victorian Liberal Party. Part of his pitch to Liberal peace electors were his media skills, which he finessed at in the United States as part of a prize for winning an essay competition held by the Conservative Senator Corey Bernardi under the umbrella of Conservative Leadership Foundation. The foundation aims to train and develop the next generation of Conservative leaders. Oh, dear God in heaven. Anyway, when you read the whole article, you can see why this link to Corey Bernardi is there. He is a nutter. And yeah, sorry.
He's a nutter, and
yeah,
he's 28. This is the interesting thing, Scott. Like, he's just given his maiden speech.
Yes.
So this other guy has only just retired recently, or something.
Oh, I couldn't tell you when he left, but
it sort of escaped me, the whole Michael Ronaldson thing. But in any event, with all the talk about a double dissolution, like, he's just given his maiden speech, and it could be as soon as like 2 months and we're having a double dissolution and he could be out on his ear with any luck. So he could literally have the shortest political career, presumably, of any. He could be the youngest and the shortest in terms of career span. And I'm hoping that's the case.
Well, I'm hoping that's the case too. But, you know, the other problem too is that, you know, that with the Senate voting reforms and all that sort of stuff that have been put up, it's looking more likely that he will survive.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, here's a few things to sound alarm bells for you, dear listener. So this 28-year-old, who most recently worked at the free market think tank, the Institute of Public Affairs. I mean, are the alarm bells just ding, ding, dinging?
Well, they already are now, but he's only... Yeah, okay. So, yeah, that's the first one that the... You got alarm bells ringing first up.
Sorry. Also, this quote, "I only want to be a minister to serve the goals of economic and personal freedom." sounds very right-wing to me.
It does sound very right-wing, you know, the whole thing about the personal freedoms.
Mm. And here's the really worrying thing about this character is on education. So he wants changes to the national curriculum, which he rubbished as biased and left-wing. And he thinks that individual schools should be able to throw out the rule book and teach as they see fit. And he cites the charter school movements in the United States, where basically schools can do what they like. And this is dangerous, Scott, because in the United States, these charter schools are in favour with, guess who? Religious right-wing nutters, because they can teach creationism and throw evolution out and teach all sorts of nasty stuff and ignore a standard curriculum. Like, what qualifications or, you know, for this 28-year-old right-wing nutter from the Institute of Public Affairs to come out and say that the curriculum is just biased and left-wing, throw it out and let individual schools teach what they want, just chaotic idea, poisonous idea. He just wants select schools for select friends to teach his poisonous notions. I've heard about him for 45 minutes, and I really dislike him a lot already.
Yeah. I don't blame you. No, he's a nutcase.
And you know, yet again, another, you know, it's all reminiscent of the United States. This is the thing in Australia, like, what's going to happen here in 5 years? We'll look across at the United States and what's happening there, and we just import all this stuff. And, you know, stupid Christian monuments... Well, we've just imported that idea. And charter schools, where schools can teach whatever they want. Well, here's a character wanting to import that idea. Not enough bad things can be said about that maiden speech, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you're dead right. I mean, there's not much that you can say about it other than just, you know, he is hoping that he does have a short career.
Mm. He's got the fingerprints of Corey Bernardi all over him, and it's a...
Oh, yeah, he does. Ugh. Yeah, for sure. He won the... You know, you go back down to the final bit where it says it links to Corey Bernardi. Mm. You know, he won a Conservative Leadership Foundation, and that's where he got his links to Corey Bernardi from. You think to yourself, bloody hell, you know, you've got to have more to it than just that, don't you?
Yeah. Scott, I've just made a little note, and as soon as the podcast finished, I'm going to Google, and, you know, what's a bet that he has a newsletter I can sign up to that's a bit like the Corey Bernardi Common Sense newsletter? So.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you might as well, yeah.
And we'll see what that produces. Right. What a start, Scott. Oh, goodness me. Yeah, if you're looking for just some general Christian bashing, you can't go beyond Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens. So
yes, yeah, late great Christopher Hitchens, yeah.
Actually, this is an article by Godless Mama and mentions a bit by Christopher Hitchens, but... Basically, the title of it is Why I Am an Anti-Theist and Why You Should Be Too. So, just a recap, dear listener. A theist is somebody, sort of a theist, somebody who believes in a god. An atheist does not believe in a god. And an anti-theist is dead set against godly notions and does their best to drive them out of the... out of the discussion and to bash them at any opportunity. So I guess, Scott, you'd definitely put me in the anti-theist category. and you're probably in the atheist category, I'd say.
Yeah, that'd be about it, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, she gives some reasons why you should be an anti-theist, and she just takes the Catholic Church as an example. So she says, well, of course there were the Crusades. More recently, the Church was in bed with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. Then she mentioned about the Catholic Church involvement in the genocide in Rwanda. Had you heard of that before?
No, I hadn't heard of that, and that was very interesting.
Mm.
That one to me, yeah.
So apparently,
I did hear about. There was some parts of it that I remembered vaguely, but not the whole lot.
Mm. So, in Rwanda, 800,000 people were murdered in a mere 100 days. And she quotes here, this is Mama, Godless Mama, several members of the church clergy have since been indicted or convicted of crimes against humanity for their roles in the genocide, including the priest who encouraged 2,000 people to take refuge in his church and then had it bulldozed with them inside. So that's some recent bad work by Catholic Church clergy. She then mentions, of course, child sex abuse. It makes the point that any one of these things would be reprehensible in any organisation, but we're talking about the Catholic Church that claims it's got, you know, the ability to tell people what's moral and what isn't. And so, you know, it's just corrupt and morally bankrupt to its very core. And final part that I like is, well, actually, in terms of corruption, she says that, if anything, religions are likely to be even more susceptible to this kind of corruption than secular institutions because of the cultural assumption that religious institutions and officials are, by default, imbued with integrity and entitled to respect. And that shies away from the harsh questions of scrutiny. So just by their very nature, that makes sense, that they are more, you know, vulnerable to corruption.
Yeah, and it does make perfect sense. Exactly the way it's been, you know, what you've read out there is exactly it.
Mm. And finishes off with a quote by Steven Weinberg, that in the morally normal universe, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion. Oh, I think that's true.
It is true, yes. Mm. Absolutely.
Scott, listeners are so up to speed on Safe Schools program that they're virtual authorities on it. And
they are, yes. Mm, yeah.
Just to add to their level of knowledge on this, interesting thought, of course, Safe Schools is being reviewed. And
the review is due to be made public either late this week or late next week.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes. Ah. Yeah, well, there was a briefing for those interested in it, and there was some talk of some of the more conservative backbenchers coming out saying it was a joke, and then, you know, I gleaned from their response, because this is the Corey Bernardis of the world and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
They said that it was a joke and it was ridiculous and so on and so forth. So I gleaned from their response was that the review was favourable towards the Safe Schools program.
Okay. Well, yes. This article I've linked on the website says that since the program was thrust into the spotlight, 32 schools have signed up and only one has withdrawn. So the furor over this has backfired, is the sort of nuts and bolts of the article, which is a good thing.
Well, it is a good thing. It's crazy that the Conservatives have actually torn themselves apart over it, because there's only 32 schools out of how many thousand across the whole country have signed up to it, and, you know, 31 of them are keeping going with it. One of them withdrawn.
No, an extra 32 have signed up.
Oh, an extra 32 have signed up. I'm sorry.
Since the there's hundreds of them already previously signed up, but
right.
In fact, since the whole program's been running, only one has withdrawn from the program. So, and in recent times, 32 have signed up. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, it is very good, yeah.
People aren't being intimidated by the religious right-wing elements in the Conservative Party.
So Senator Patterson and others being ignored.
Yes. Scott, I'm going early on the quiz. Here.
Oh, you're going early on the quiz. Okay. Mm. Right.
So the quiz, the Essential Report came out again. And we'll kick off with their usual one. Two-party preferred, Liberal National and Labor. What do you reckon the percentages are, Scott?
50-50.
Spot on. Very good. same-sex marriage, Scott. Current should be allowed to marry, should not be allowed to marry, and don't knows.
Should be allowed to marry, it'd be 60%. Not be allowed to marry, it'd be 30%. 10% would be, I don't know.
Pretty close. 64 yeah. say yes, 26 say no, 10% undecided.
Mm.
Interestingly, Scott, they've got a bit of a history of their polling on this going back to 2010. So for each year, should same-sex couples be allowed to marry, starting in 2010 and going through till now, the figures have just gradually increased. It was 53, 54, 55, 57, 60%, 59%, and now 64%. So just a gradual change in sentiment in the community in the last 6 years.
Ooh.
Makes sense.
Ooh.
And the final one, Scott, is the question, same-sex marriage, should this be decided by Parliament or should there be a national vote, i.e. plebiscite, that we're going to have? So what do you reckon people think? Do they think that it should have been the Parliament or it should have been a plebiscite?
I'm going to say that the majority think it should have been by Parliament rather than by plebiscite.
Okay.
So I don't know. Probably 50% and 40% and 10% don't know.
Okay, you're way out.
Okay.
So only 23% think that this should have been done by Parliament and done and dusted.
Is that right?
Yep. 66% say there should be a national vote. 11% don't knows, which I think for this sort of thing is relatively small. So despite the fact that 64% want same-sex marriages, most of them don't want our Parliament to just go ahead and do it. They actually want to vote. So, Scott, where it's been swimming against the tide on that one.
Well, it certainly looks that way, but it is, you know, I mean, I still maintain that part of what Malcolm Turnbull's problems are currently with the electorate is that he has been tied by the more right wing of his party, and he's been tied by the more right wing Conservative National Party, and I do think that had he just come out and said, no, we're just going to have a conscience vote in the Parliament, I think that a lot of his problems would evaporate.
Yeah, I reckon he would have got away with it because guess what? The next day, the sun still would have come up in the morning.
Still come up in the morning.
The birds would have been singing and, you know, life would have continued on and people would have gone, gosh, what was all the fuss about?
Exactly.
So anyway, that was an interesting statistic, that last one, Scott. So 2 out of
yeah,
3.
For sure.
I'm giving you 2 points out of a possible 3 on the quiz. Well done. Now, Scott.
Yes.
Interesting article. This about herbal remedies. Did I send you this one?
No.
Okay.
But was this the one that was linked on Facebook just recently about, where they've pulled it all apart and found that the herbal remedies don't contain the herbs that they're supposed to contain?
Yeah, well, it turns out, dear listener, that there's two problems with herbal remedies. The first is that they don't remedy, and the second is there's no herbs.
Yeah.
So I think we all would probably not be surprised by the first. Their powers of healing are extremely limited. But it turns out that they don't even put the herbs in there. Like, this is an investigation by the US Food and Drug Administration into popular herbal medicines, and that, it says here 80% of the products have no herbal content either. Like, so all this ginkgo biloba and St. John's wort and all these other things, well, instead of that, it's just got rice flour, asparagus, dried radish and wheat and beans and peas and carrots, but no detectable levels of herbs. Isn't that amazing? Well, it's not amazing, is it? I mean, who would have thought that in the herbal medicine industry there would be unscrupulous characters, Scott?
Well, it's crazy that you would think that you were going to be buying exactly what they claim was in the stuff anyway.
Anyway, just as an aside, later in the article, they said that Parmesan cheese, in certain circumstances, they found as much as 9% wood in Parmesan cheese. People just filling up their Parmesan cheese with a bit of wood chip just to make things cheaper. God. There
crazy,
you go. So,
isn't it?
So be careful when next you order your herbal medicine to check whether it really does have herbs in it.
Yeah.
Scott, what are you doing on Saturday the 23rd of April in Sydney? I don't think I've sent this one to you.
No, I don't recall anything on the 23rd of April, no.
Where else would you rather be than the ACL National Conference?
Oh, that's true, yes. I must better book a flight down there now, hadn't I?
Yeah. Yes. The theme of the conference is cultivating courage, Scott. Because, according to the blurb, there is no doubt it is becoming harder to be a Christian in Australia. Elite.
Oh, please.
Elite opinion mocks faith. Media often scoffs at any trace of timeless Christian faith. But our nation has been blessed and shaped by the transforming power of the gospel. In these uncertain times, we can draw hope and courage from the answers that Christianity has to offer to society's most difficult problems and saddest injustices. And you can log on and you can buy tickets and you can appear. You can, you know, not appear, but you can attend. So
yeah, okay. So, you know, they're saying that you've got to be frightened, that you're frightened if you're a Christian now, are you?
Yeah, they're getting such a hard run.
They're getting such a hard run that you've got idiots like Corey Bernardi and this Patterson bloke standing up in the Senate and saying what they actually say. And then you've got other idiots. Well, you know, John Howard's recent outburst was crazy. But he said, what do you say? He said, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he said basically that that Christians were feeling that they couldn't say what they wanted to say.
Yes, that's right. Oh, look, they love to be, they love to feel persecuted, the Christians.
Oh, yeah, they do.
So, so Scott, interesting on this program is the speakers who are going to be there. And, you know, there's the usual suspects, Lowell Shelton, Jim Wallace, Wendy Francis, a few other names that look familiar. Now I'm doing it. Miranda Devine. Sorry, not Wendy Devine. Miranda Devine. Anyway.
Is she a godmother, is she?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But two names stand out for me on the speaker list, Scott. One of whom is the Honourable Scott Morrison, MP. The Treasurer of the Commonwealth of Australia. You know, this is in the same blurb that says how, you know, it's hard to be a Christian and, you know, come out and say stuff. Meanwhile, the second speaker is the Treasurer of Australia. Like, I don't think he's worried about speaking.
He's not. And, you know, if we can just go back to that plebiscite again now, he actually was one of those that said that you shouldn't have to vote the way your constituency votes.
Yes.
Now, you know, given that you've got 64% of the population saying that they're in favour of same-sex marriage, I think that his electorate would be one of those that would return a yes vote.
Probably.
So, you know, that makes it very interesting for him. How does he then go ahead and claim that he shouldn't have to vote yes?
Look, I'm okay with that. I think because you're never going to agree 100% with the majority of your constituents, probably. But it's just that the constituents who just vote him out. If it's such a key issue and they think the other way, then hopefully that's enough for them to kick him out. So, you know, I don't want politicians to sort of be polling their electorate and just doing whatever the electorate says I'd like them to have some principles, so I'm okay with that. But I just like his electorate to vote him out. So the other
name—I
don't
think his electorate's going to vote him out. But anyway,
the other name, Scott, that appears on this list, and this might be a surprise to some people, but avid listeners of the Iron Fist Velvet Glove podcast, they're going to have an aha moment here, Scott, and you'll have one as well. You ready for this speaker? This is at the Australian Christian Lobby National Conference. Noel Pearson.
Yes.
His claim to fame, as we've mentioned before for us, is that he thought it was one of the greatest things in his life that the Bible was translated into his native Aboriginal language, and that was such a significant thing for him. So no surprise that Noel Pearson.
No, it's no surprise at all, but it is also somewhat disconcerting that a man who, you know, I've said this before when we first spoke about this, is that considering he's a leader of his people, you would think that he would find something more important than to go on with than, you know, what he's decided to play the field for.
Yeah. I mentioned before how Christians love, you know, being persecuted.
Mm.
And there was an incident recently in the world news where this Christian guy charged at a pack of lions that were feeding on a carcass, and he thought he'd been, you know, told by God to sort of test himself. And he started running to the lions, and the lions, with blood dripping out of their mouths, looked up and saw this character running at them and thought, well, here's another meal being delivered. And started chasing after him. He turns around and starts running the other way, and they land on top of him, and he's lost half of his backside, and a gamekeeper has seen this and saved the guy. But, you know, Christians love being persecuted so much that they're prepared to feed themselves to lions these days, Scott. That's what it's come to.
It is crazy that they actually feed themselves to lions, though, isn't it?
Mm. Another article I've got here was by Brian Morris, who was the author of Sacred to Secular, we mentioned ages ago, and guts of the article is that religions claim this moral high ground, but they have nothing to say about income inequality, and they are just happy for their constituents to remain poor as church mice, because then they're, I reckon, more easily controlled and susceptible to religion. So,
I think that's exactly it, yeah.
You know, it's a major issue, and you don't hear religious groups talking about inequality.
No, you don't, and that's because they've fallen under the influence of the right wing of the Republican Party in the US.
Correct, and the right wing of
the Liberal Party down under.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly right. Oh, Scott. Oh, a brief article about Christian Democrats. That's the
the Reverend Fred Nile and his ilk. Yeah, the CDP have focused on a relatively small number of people who attend church weekly, approximately 8% of the population, who they believe already rusted onto the party. They're extremely satisfied with the CDP, according to the McKindle research. I find that hard to believe that they've got, you know, the audience rusted on like that.
Yeah.
You know, I find that really hard to believe.
Oh, I don't know. It seems possible to me, but it sort of makes the point that a large number of Christians have never heard of the CDP and saying that's a problem. And unfortunately for us, Scott, more Christians know about the CDP than secular people know about the secular party. So.
Well, that's true, yes.
Dear listener, just do something about that. Can you just go onto Facebook, like the page, share it with some friends? There's an election coming up. We've just told you half a dozen crazy things that are going on in this country. And just tell your friends that you're going to, that you like the secular party, and have a look at it. Because we've got to get the word out there somehow.
We do need to get the word out there somehow. And then, so if people can share the Facebook link, then that'd be great to start.
Oh, Scott, one of my favourite discussion topics is this whole, you know, religious people consider themselves to be so moral. Where would we be without religion? How would we determine our morals? And there's just data always comes up to say that, well, in fact, religious people aren't very moral at all. And the Pew Research Center in America, God, I wish they would do these sorts of studies in Australia. But anyway, they polled the population on whether the use of torture against suspected terrorists was can often be justified, can sometimes be justified, rarely justified, never justified. So you've got, you know, a propensity to approve of torture or a propensity, you know, to disapprove of torture. And I'll give you one guess, Scott. White evangelical Protestants. Do you reckon they're more inclined on the torture side or less?
I'd say they're more inclined to back to torture.
Correct. Despite, Scott, reading their Bibles thoroughly and noting down all the verses that include torture. Hang on a minute. Yeah, maybe not in spite of, perhaps because of all of the clauses in the Bible calling for torture and whatever. Who knows? But anyway, the more right-wing Christian you are, the more likely you are to approve of torture. So much for moral superiority.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Mm. You know, and then you got that other article that you sent me. The research shows link between conservative Christianity and crime.
Mm.
You know, it's crazy that you would then. Well, you know, I mean, go through and read it yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. But you know, why does religion cause crime? Sparks the answer to the questions with 3 points. The explicit theology of violence presented in fundamentalist religions. The psychology attendant by insulting oneself from fear or of death through religion. And 3, and the promulgation of laws, policies and programs to address crime and stem from belief system. You know, it's there. You know, it's crazy to think that you can avoid crime by having a religious belief.
Yep. So we're just going to have these stats at our fingertips so that when these people say, oh, but at least with religion you get sort of some moral guidance, we go, well, hang on a minute.
No, you don't. Yeah.
Hard statistics on torture, on crime, on all sorts of things show, in fact, exactly the opposite.
Exactly.
Mm.
Mm.
Scott, Catholic News. Mother Teresa, they're going to make her a saint.
Yes.
And what they've had to do within the Vatican is overhaul the sort of financial transparency rules in relation to saint-making, Scott, because believe it or not, folks, but some underhanded things happen when making saints. So the article is sort of noting that it's an expensive exercise
€500,000
to beatify a saint because, I mean, these things have to be checked, Scott. I mean, when somebody claims that they prayed to Mother Teresa and as a result their tumour has disappeared, well, you know, you need to go and speak to various people and that costs money. Just ignore what they say anyway and still beatify, but and that's probably costs even more money. Got to pay people off. So anyway, if you've got a sort of a saint who's popular, then all sorts of money flows in donation-wise to help the process, and then there might be other saints who are not quite as popular, and they could languish along not being beatified because of lack of funds, and what seems to have been happening is that there's been a bit of cross-subsidisation going on where people are providing money, for example, for the beatification of Mother Teresa, and some of that money is going towards helping the beatification of a different saint. So good on the Catholic Church for cleaning up this financial irregularity, Scott. I mean, they're working on the big issues again, and they're making sure that if you donate money to beatify one saint, it's not going to be spent on beatifying another saint. And I'm going to sleep easy at night now, knowing that's the case.
Well, I'm pleased you'll sleep easier at night now. So, you know, it's,
speaking of mother,
I was just stunned that it cost 500,000 euros.
Yeah.
Up to the beatification stage.
What do you reckon when a cardinal from the Vatican has to travel to, you know, Brazil to take statements from people on, you know, what happened? Do you reckon he travels first class?
Well, I reckon he would. Yeah.
Yep. I reckon he would as well. It all adds up.
Well, it does, but it's still crazy that it costs that amount of money.
Mm. Scott, did I give you the figures on birth control? Does that sound familiar to you?
No, but there was an article that I remember reading about birth control. Yeah, go on.
So, still in the Catholic Church, like, the single most important thing you could do in the world today to help alleviate human suffering is to empower women in poor countries, and in particularly empower them in relation to birth control so that they're not producing a dozen kids, so they've got a manageable number, and then all sorts of things flow from that. You've got less people to feed, you've got, you know, chance to educate and improve lives. Like, it is without doubt the single best thing you could do to help the world suffering. And, of course,
exactly. The
Catholic Church is dead set against any form of birth control through contraceptives. So, you know, A, that's, again, just evil on their part. But interesting, Scott, I stumbled across this article about unintended pregnancy in the United States. So, I mean, basically, to sort of make the point, it's hard enough in the United States for women to control their fertility, let alone in a poor country in Latin America or in Africa, for example.
Yeah.
So, a little bit of definition here, folks, before we go on. So, in this study, which is done by Guttmacher Institute, they talk about an unintended pregnancy is one which is either unwanted or it's mistimed, in the sense that the person would like to be pregnant at some stage, but just not now.
Mm.
So that's an unintended pregnancy, and as opposed to an intended pregnancy. And we're talking about the United States of America. And by the age of 45, Scott, more than half of all American women will have experienced an unintended pregnancy. And 3 in 10 will have had an abortion. Isn't that amazing?
That's really quite a very high number, 3 in 10, isn't it?
Mm. The unintended pregnancy rate is significantly higher in the United States than in many other developed countries. So by the age of 45, more than half have had a pregnancy which is they either didn't want full stop or didn't want at that moment in life. So, astounding statistics.
That is really quite bizarre, yeah.
So there's a link to that on the website, folks. It seems very scientific. It seems to have all sorts of footnotes. And, for example, that statistic I just read about abortion is footnoted from the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology, 2011, page 117, subsection 6. So, seems to be all legit. If you're interested in that one, just goes to show it's not easy.
Very bizarre.
Scott, private school funding.
Yes. One of your own little hobby horses to push this barrel on, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. So there is an article here by Eric Bagshaw, education reporter. This is from July 16th,
Sydney Morning Herald,
2015. Yeah. And there's some interesting statistics here, but here's the really interesting one as an example. The Rooty Hill High School educates more than 1,000 students in Sydney's West. It's got a below average socioeconomic rating of 958. It currently receives $10,469 per student from the state and federal government. Okay, so Rooty Hill, each student, $10,469. The independent Shoalhaven Anglican School educates 300 students and has a much higher socioeconomic rating of 1037, and it receives only $6 less per student than Rooty Hill. Our system is completely stuffed.
It is completely buggered. If that's the best our system can come up with, then you've really got to ask. I mean, how the hell do they calculate that?
Yeah.
That they're getting $10,463 in an independent Shoalhaven school. You know, and that doesn't take into account what they're then gouging the parents for.
Exactly. So then the parents chip in for a similar amount. Then you've got an incredibly unequal situation.
Mm.
And, of course, any of the kids with problems in the community are going to end up in the high school. So they're going to have to deal with the tough and difficult students who've got issues, and Shoalhaven Anglican is going to have a free ride on the best possible kids to teach.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So our school funding is completely out of whack, and I can't work out, Scott, the whole Gonski story, where we are, and what it seems like the last 2 years of funding have not been approved, but these are the most crucial 2 years, like really nothing sort of significantly changed, but without the last 2 years. If somebody, dear listener out there, is an expert on Gonski or can provide me a link to show exactly where we're at with that, it's really hard for me to find stuff and get my head around it. But that examples I just gave of Rooty Hill versus the Shoalhaven Anglican just shows that our system is currently stuffed.
It is buggered. Yeah, it's completely stuffed.
Mm. Scott. Okay, so that was that one. And the other thing on that topic is that, you know, the government's...
Most private schools can't prove they spend the money, their government funds appropriately, says the watchdog.
Yeah.
This is from The Age.
Mm-hmm.
Tina Jacks, the education reporter. Mm. Hundreds of millions of dollars in education department grants are being given to private schools with no measures to track how the money is being spent, an auditor general report found. I mean, like, that in itself is crazy when you just read that.
Yep.
But you find out that, you know, they just hand over this, you know, cash, well, can't hand over the cash, the check, what have you, and then they don't have any KPIs, anything like that. It's crazy.
But hang on,
they would just hand it.
Hang on, Scott.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of a situation where a government has handed over large amounts of money to an organisation, and it's unaccountable, and things have gone bad?
Yes, I have.
When have you not? Like, it's almost guaranteed. If you're going to throw around large amounts of money and not make people accountable for how it's spent, you are setting up a disaster.
You're setting it up. You really are. Yeah. You know, in a scathing report, Acting Auditor General Dr. Peter Frost said the Education Department had weak funding agreements with the schools, no performance measurements or targets, and that schools were unable to prove funds were spent as they were intended.
Mm.
I mean, like, that's just in itself... criminal.
Yep.
That you have, well, $10,463 a student being handed over to Shoalhaven,
yep,
independent Anglican school, and for what?
You don't know.
That's it. Yeah, it's crazy.
So they did a sample audit of 22 schools, and not one of them could prove that their funding was not used on capital works, which is forbidden.
Yeah.
So Only 20% of schools receiving student disability grants could prove that the money was used for the purpose for which it was intended, i.e. for the helping disabled kids. Only 20% could prove that. So, and the other thing is, Scott, the goddamn Catholics. So what happens with the Catholic system is the government gives lump sum amount to central Catholic head office, who then distributes it amongst the individual Catholic schools. So, and there's just no guarantee that the poorer schools receive what they should be receiving. And in fact, well, let me read this bit here. The audit revealed that due to funding model that relates only to Catholic schools, some wealthier Catholic schools receive substantially more in government grants than they would have under the department's funding arrangement, while poorer schools received less. So the Catholics give this overall statistics, take the money and then redistribute it amongst their schools, paying no attention to who are the most needy. I mean, we've got to educate the Catholic central authority on the notion that you need to provide more money to the most needy. This is where we're at, Scott.
It's crazy. It really is crazy that you would have to say to them that, you know, you've got to give more to the more needy than you do the your richer people. I mean, like, I find that incredible that you would have to go down to that level and educate them in that regard. It's crazy.
Oh, Scott, oh, for some power. If only you could introduce legislation that just hit these guys between the eyeballs and with a good dose of reality and made them have to do these things. They would scream like banshees, but God, it would feel good.
Yeah, but I mean, even with that, when Gonski was announced, you know, they always seem to fall back on this, you know, you can't, no one should be worse off.
Yes.
Well, you know, I think that considering the numbers that we just pulled out there, $10,463 per student and an independent school, it's crazy that they would not be worse off.
Mm.
I mean, it's ridiculous that you have this situation that they're getting thousands of dollars per head, then this other article saying that they're not held to account for how they spend it.
Yep.
You know, it's madness. It really is madness.
And this just goes to the guts of our society, Scott, because it means that we don't have equality of education for everybody, and we end up developing, you know, the great thing about Australian society is it's relatively classless compared to others, but more and more we will be developing haves and have-nots in a class-based sense, which is just not going to do us any good at all. And the education system is a key for all that, and it's currently stuffed.
It is, yeah. It's crazy.
Scott, have you ever... the confession is only in the Catholic realm, is that right?
Yeah, it is.
See, I was brought up a Catholic, of course, so I can kind of remember my first confession.
Yeah?
Kind of spooky experience. And
you went in there and said, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned."
Yes, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." It is. And then you go, "X number of weeks or months since my last confession, and these are my sins." And so for your first confession, you can, you know, it's my first confession. You're all doing it together. Sorry, you know, all the same allotted day and sort of a big ceremony. And but it's obviously in private with the priest, and you're in that little cubicle and the thing slides across. And I can still remember, Scott, like I wasn't a saint by any means, but I couldn't. I couldn't think of a sin, but like everybody else, I would have made... I made them up. It was like, I stole a rubber from somebody, or, you know, I lied three times, and I did this, or... Like, actually, I can distinctly remember making up sins just to get out of there.
She had something to say, yeah.
I don't think it would have gone too well if I'd have said, you know...
bless me, Father, but actually, I'm pretty good. I haven't done anything, and I'd just like to go now. Thanks. I reckon the priest would have broken the seal of the confessional and said something to the nuns and said, watch that Trevor Bell. He's not to be trusted. But anyway, I said, I made up some sins and, you know, I was told I had to say 3 Hail Marys and 6 Our Fathers or something like that as penance and whooshka. Oh, I had a clean soul at that point, Scott. If I had walked out of the church and got run over by a truck, I would have been going straight to heaven, according to Catholic doctrine. So that didn't happen. But in the Vatican, or in, at the moment, Scott, a little article about at St. Peter's Basilica, they've got a team of priests there who are just full-time hearing confessions. That people.
Jeez, it's a bloody boring job, isn't it?
Well, it depends, you know. If they've committed adultery, I guess the priest might. Really? I mean, tell me more. You know, in order. Exactly. What did you do? So, depending on the sin, who knows, Scott? But what they're saying is that. The English language priests have fewer confessions to hear this year due to the downturn in tourists because of the lack of downturn in tourism generally because of terrorism, I think. And the other thing that was noted in the article was a phenomenon where increasingly finding people coming for confessions who are not Catholics. They want to confess to see what it is all about. So, while confessors can listen to and counsel non-Catholics, it's not considered a sacramental confession in most cases. So, there you go, dear listener. If you're in St. Peter's Basilica and you're thinking back to episode 36 of the Iron Fist and Velvet Glove about the confessions, you...
Yeah, go see one of the English speakers because apparently they've all got time on their hands right
just
now.
Just go up and admit that you're not Catholic if you're not and just say you'd like to have a go. And that's something to do in St. Peter's Basilica. Oh, Scott.
You never know. It could change your life.
While you're there, you could check with the priest. Got an article here, 11 kinds of Bible verses that Christians love to ignore. And just a couple.
I haven't got that one. Got that one? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No.
There's some weird insults and curses, Scott. You remember from Monty Python, they had some, you know, in the Holy Grail where they're like trying to attack a castle and it's like French guys... sort of hurling insults from the parapet down to them. And your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
So there's some curses in the Bible. And Ezekiel 23, verse 20. She lusted after her lovers, whose genitals were like those of donkeys and whose emission was like that of horses. Like, just... There's some weird stuff in the Bible. Also in the Bible are some awkwardly useless commandments. You shall not wear clothing woven into two kinds of material, Leviticus. So throw out your polyester cotton. And ye shall not round the corners of your heads. That's Leviticus as well. This is the one that I quite liked. Deuteronomy, chapter 25, verse... is 11 to 12. You can look these ones up. But and this is the sort of thing, Scott. Remember when they were doing the Bible reading in the opposite Parliament House and it was like a Bible marathon for 72 hours? We need to find these passages and read them next time because this would go down a treat.
Yeah, exactly.
I particularly would enjoy shouting this one out. When men fight with one another and the wife of the one... draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him, and puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts, then you shall cut off her hand. It's fair dinkum in the Bible. And finally, Deuteronomy again. No one whose testicles are crushed or whose penis is cut off shall be admitted to the assembly of God, of the Lord. So, yeah, they don't like people with physical handicaps in the Bible. So there's some bits of craziness. We haven't had any crazy Bible verses for a while, Scott.
No, we haven't.
I think I made up for it then. Did I send you the one on evangelical Christianity destroying its brand?
Yes, you did, yes.
So,
Here's why they are now widely despised. Yes. It is very interesting. It goes back to what I said earlier, that the Christians were now under the control of the right wing of the Republican Party. And it is a... Oh, where are we? You go through the whole article, and then it comes down to the end bit where they have 8 reasons why the whole thing has fallen apart.
Yep.
You know, it's crazy when you actually pull it all apart. American evangelical leaders sold their congregations to the Republican Party in exchange for political power. Evangelical Christianity is now distinctive and widely despised. Another way to put it is the evangelical brand has gone from being an asset to a liability. It is a very interesting article.
Yeah.
Humanist commentator James Cross argues that Trump is evangelicalism. In the hands of the religious right has become. The religious right in America has always been a political philosophy based on bullying, pandering, projecting strength to hide fear and weakness, and proud, aggressive ignorance. And I think, you know, that in itself, when you see what's coming out of the US, out of their primaries right now, it really does speak volumes.
Yeah, I did like that bit where it said that, it's bullying, pandering, projecting strength to hide fear and weakness, and proud, aggressive ignorance. Like, that sums it up. And it says, that's what it's been about from the beginning. Trump has merely distilled those elements into a decoction so deadly that even some evangelicals are starting to recognize the venom they have injected into American culture. Here's what the evangelical brand looks like from the outside. And one, evangelical means obsessed with sex. They are so desperate to fend off their own complicated sexual desires and self-loathing, they would rather watch queer teens commit suicide than deal with homophobia. So sex is one thing. They're arrogant. They're fearful and bigoted. They're indifferent to the truth because they refuse to acknowledge what is so obvious to everyone, i.e. the Bible is a human document with moral and factual imperfections, but they refuse to believe it. They're ignorant because the only way to protect creationism is to keep people from understanding how science works. They're predatory and they're just mean. They oppose anti-poverty programs. They shame and stigmatize queers. Make it hard for poor people to prevent pregnancy. They blame rape victims. They divert aid dollars into church coffers. They threaten little kids with eternal torture. They support war. Do you need to go on? And basically evangelical Christianity sold out to the Republicans, and their brand, according to this article, is now ruined. So some truth in that, I think.
I think there's a hell of a lot of truth to that article, yeah.
Scott, I think... Have you got any that you really wanted to mention at this point before we think about something else?
Just the Pakistan law criminalising violence against women is declared un-Islamic.
Yes.
A new law that criminalises violence against women is found to be un-Islamic in Pakistan. The largest province, Punjab, last week gives legal protection to women suffering from domestic, psychological, sexual violence. In addition, the new legislation calls for the creation of a toll-free abuse reporting hotline and the establishment of women's shelters. You know, it's pretty much basic stock standard stuff that we are used to over here.
Yep.
But it's been declared to be un-Islamic.
Yes.
You know, it's crazy. Yeah. It really is crazy.
Yep. So, and just also on, well, that neck of the woods, in Egypt, they have brought about a law that has been unveiled for banning the niqab or full face veil in Egypt. And you think to yourself,
public, yeah.
Well, isn't that fantastic? Like, finally, they are seeing some sense and they're going to ban that disgusting garment. But, Scott, the reason for banning it was that they consider it is, in fact, not Islamic in the true tradition, and that's why they're banning it.
So, yeah, it's crazy.
So they get the right result, but for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
On that one, so, yeah. All right, Scott, well, there's various other ones on the list, but we can put them down for another time. And
no worries.
Yeah, you're away on holidays.
I am away on holidays the next 2 weeks, so I imagine I'll be leaving you in the hands of the velvet of the
twelfth man. So
yes,
Scott, I think we've done an impressive amount of holidaying. You know, we're up to we're up to episode 36. Between you and me, we've done well on the holiday front.
We have done well, yes.
Let that be a lesson for you, dear listener. You know, get into this full-on secularism / anti-theism and look at the holidays that follow. If, you know, if correlation is causation, then join up is what I say.
Yes. Mm. So please get involved and, you know, seeing we're going to start polling for votes pretty soon, I should imagine. So, give us your vote in the Senate.
This Sunday, Scott, is our meeting in Queensland.
It is our meeting this Sunday.
So,
yes.
We're having a bit of a debate. So, we're going to air on, well, this podcast will be published around the 17th of March, 18th. And so, this Sunday, 1 o'clock, Brisbane City Council Library, a bit of a debate about hard and soft secularism and which one the secular party should be adopting. So more than welcome to come along if you're in the area. So
yes, please do come along.
All right, Scott, very good. We shall talk
thank you very
to
much
you.
For listening.
Well, I'll see you Sunday. Everyone else will hear your dulcet tones in about episode 39 and we will stumble along without you until then.
No worries. Okay, well, thanks very much for listening, everyone. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to, and maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon. And there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that, whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event,
You can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.